Okay. Well, good to see you all back. And we'll start as usual by setting the motivation with the lines of safe direction and generation of bodhicitta. So, thank you, Faye. That's very good. Sangye Chodeng Soki Chonam La Changchub Badu Dakni Kyapsu Shi Dage Chunyen Gipe Sonam Gi Drola Panchir Sangye Drupa Jo Sangye Chodeng Soki Chonam La Changchub Badu Dakni Kyapsu Shi Dage chunyen gipe sonam gi drola panchir sangye drupa jo. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Thank you very much. And in that spirit, let's engage with the retreat once more. So, we were talking about sameness and difference, having got a kind of a feel for being able to identify just what it is, you know, that sense of I, that reified I that we kind of assume most of the time is there, kind of appearing to exist in a way that it really doesn't. And I think we've all had some good insights into the way it doesn't. But of course, because it's such a deeply ingrained habit, when we're thinking about it in the moment or talking about it like now, we kind of see it, we can know it in a sense. But because the habits are very deeply ingrained, we pop back, we just slip back into the mode of thinking and assuming that it exists in the way that it appears. So that's why a lot of the work in meditation and studying the logic and the philosophy and applying it in meditation and experientially continuing to feel one's way into it in meditation repeatedly over long periods of time and kind of reminding oneself of it is a way that it really starts to be able to penetrate and change the habits, the habitual ways of thinking, the very conditioned ways of thinking. I keep re-recognizing, re-reminding, devoting time to reading about it, devoting time to doing meditations on it and making them deeper, and then resting with the conclusions that you have. To keep pursuing the practice in that way really does start to have an impact on the over-reified concrete nature of the appearance of this I, get a better understanding of it, and then the kind of habitual and mechanical assumptions around it have less and less grip or purchase, and we have the benefits of being liberated from that. And liberation from that is, as we've seen, it's really the root cause, that basic ignorance of not understanding that things don't exist in the way they appear really is the root cause of suffering. So it really is a fundamental way of cutting off the root of ignorance and bringing about a cessation of suffering. But unless we're very, very lucky, it's not an instant quick fix kind of method. So it's something we keep coming back to, and it's worth keep trying to come back to, keep in focus just what it is we think is there that in actual fact isn't, and then to kind of look at the various ways of understanding the consequences of believing it's like that and the kind of logic involved. And this method that we're using now, it's the one that His Holiness also uses, is but one of many. in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, and it's sort of like it's considered to be one and sameness, or same as different. It's only one argument. There are quite a few others, but you know, it's best to start with something, deepen it a bit and carry on, and then you can expand it. And also there's a bit also what's called the King of Reasons, which is a deeper understanding of interdependence. Because if you understand conditioned co-production and interdependence, and begin to get an understanding of that as being synonymous with emptiness, then of course that also kind of liberates from the idea of there being any kind of fundamental, singular, permanent, partless, existing wholly from its own side, self-sufficient kind of entity in anything at all. So it's those two that really we've been playing with in a serious sense so far. But there was one while I was having my own break, as it were, I came across a rather good piece that goes, if you remember, when we started, when we moved really to the second step, when we started move from identifying experientially just what this reified sense of self was, before we moved to the second step, there was that quote from the Buddha in respect of what's going on here being like his analysis of the chariot. In contemporary terms, it could be an analysis of the car. It's quite a good one of those. In Jeffrey Hopkins, got a book called Emptiness Yoga, in which he puts the chariot analysis into a car. But I found a very, very good, short enough section that uses that analysis to really explain the same or different logic. So I thought, as it's short, you might enjoy to hear it. It's from a book called Introduction to Emptiness, as taught in Tsongkhapa's great treatise on the stages of the path. That's his Lamrim Chen Mo, by a man called Guy Newland, he's a practitioner and a very good academic. You know, Buddhist philosophy is his academic training and profession, as it were. So I'll read from him here. Madhyamaka treatises include many different arguments refuting any essentialist view, the essentialist view being the one that there is some singular, permanent, partless, existing from its own side, self-sufficient kind of thing. So he says, Madhyamaka treatises include the many different arguments refuting any essentialist view. In the great treatise, Lamrim Chen Mo, Tsongkhapa describes the process of meditative analysis of the intrinsic self of the person, mainly in terms of one particular argument known as lack of sameness and difference. He first exemplifies how this argument works by analysing a chariot, and Tsongkhapa picked up this analogy of the chariot from the teaching of the Buddha, and then applies the same arguments to the person. Tsongkhapa's explanation of the lack of sameness and difference begins by describing what has been known as the law of excluded middle. It's sometimes been said, quite erroneously, it's just not true, that this principle is absent in non-Western logics. Sometimes we still encounter the perspective that Asian religions, or Buddhism in particular, are about mystical experience to the exclusion of rational analysis. So he says, let's consider one of Tsongkhapa's statements of the excluded middle in the Lamrim Chen Mo. So this is now quoting from the English translation of Lama Tsongkhapa. In the general case, we see in the world that when a phenomenon is mentally classified as accompanied, it's precluded from being unaccompanied. And when it's classified as unaccompanied, it is precluded from being accompanied. In general, therefore, same and different, as well as singular and plural, preclude any further alternative, because the unaccompanied and the accompanied are respectively singular and plural. You know, it's either one or the other. So then back to Guy Newland. In other words, accompanied and unaccompanied, like wed and unwed, are ex and not ex. What is accompanied is alone singular and identical to itself. It is not diverse because it is one thing. What is accompanied is plural and diverse. So the basic principle that anything that exists must be either ex or not ex entails that anything that exists must be either singular or plural, must be either self-identical or diverse. Tsongkhapa then uses this principle to limit the alternatives in the analysis of intrinsic nature or inherent existence. And then, so he quotes a little Tsongkhapa, when you determine in the general case that anything must be either one or not one, then you will also determine that for the particular case of something that exists essentially, it must be either essentially one or essentially different. Back to Guy Newland. So if a chariot, for example, had an essential or intrinsic nature, such would have to be demonstrated by rigorous analysis of whether it's identical to its parts or intrinsically different from them. Is the chariot the same as its parts? No. For if it were, then just as the parts of a chariot are several and diverse, so the chariot too would be plural. Or else, just as there's a single chariot, there would only be one part. If the chariot were identical to its parts, then, since we say the chariot has parts, the possessing agent would be identical to the possessed object. If agent and object could be identical in this way, then fire and fuel could just as well be identical. Simply putting a log, the burned object, in a cold fireplace should warm up the room, because the burned object is the same as the burning agent, fire. On the other hand, a chariot is not essentially separate from its parts, because if it were, we could see cases of chariots appearing without any chariot parts, just as horses and cows can appear separately insofar as they are separate. Since a chariot can be found neither among its parts nor essentially separate from them, it must lack an essential nature. This is because if there were an essentially existent chariot, it would have to be findable under this sort of analysis. The knowledge that things lack essential reality is a liberating insight into emptiness, the absence of intrinsic existence. Another important point to note is that for Tsongkhapa, the final basis for any argument, including this refutation of essential reality, is information provided by ordinary conventional consciousness. We see that a log is different from a flame, that a horse is different from a cow, that being accompanied is different from being unaccompanied. It is from this ordinary factual knowledge that we can develop arguments against essential nature. Our ordinary conventional consciousnesses are mistaken in that a log appears to them as though it were essentially real. But at the same time, these conventional consciousnesses provide accurate and practical information. Not only can we use this information to light a fire or select a car, but we also definitely need this information in order to form the argument against essential nature. As Tsongkhapa says, here he's quoting from Tsongkhapa, even when you analyze reality, the final basis for any critique derives from unimpaired conventional consciousnesses. And then he goes in a little bit there to the application of sameness and difference to the person, but we'll save any more of that until we've done a little more, as it were. But I thought that was a, if anybody was still pondering, and I hope you were, kind of thinking, well, the logic, sameness and difference, what's going on here? How's it being used as an analytical tool? I thought that might be helpful in getting clear about that. And there is also, from a logical point of view, and I think you can understand it, there are lots of forms of logic which are different to the Aristotelian. And in that sense, Buddhist logic is regarded as non-classical, but not deviant. The thing that marks that out is it doesn't deny the law of excluded middle, because it sees its usefulness, yeah, in that very way. The problem with denying or saying, well, I don't really care about the law of excluded middle, is that it generates really difficult contradictions. You know, can a thing both be in the same place and not be there at the same time? Well, if you enter into quantum physics and Schrodinger's cat and all of that, you'll be familiar with it's that contradiction that raises the strangeness or the queerness of certain elements in quantum physics. But what that's pointing to is we clearly haven't got the explanation right. Not that there's no law of excluded middle, that there's a conundrum here that we don't understand. But by and large, at a conventional level, it's sort of, you know, I can't be me and not me, or I can't be here and not here. I must be one or the other. So that's where this is the principle on which this argument of same or different is coming, that we're starting to use on our experience as sort of articulation of this assumption of an inherently existing self. By applying that analysis, looking at whether it's the same, looking at whether it's different, and seeing if we can come up with anything under that analysis that actually kind of conforms to our assumptions about it. And of course, if we can't, the extent to which we've gone there properly is the extent to which we say, well, oh, oops. We can't. No, we can't. There's no. There, you start to deconstruct or undermine with simple intellectual rigorous argument that there could be any such thing, and then your experiential feel into it, as we were saying, you can't come up with it that way either, because you think, oh yeah, there's nothing of that sort. There's a sense of self that arises. It's dynamic. It comes and goes, can be more intense or less intense, and arises in dependence on many different causes and conditions and circumstances. And if you bring these two together and actually do it in periods of, you know, with a little bit of study, a little bit of reflection, and then bring it into analytical meditation on a stable basis, you know, the stable attentional stability and balance of shamatha, then it really, over time, it really does begin to permeate the way we are, and indeed, I think, transform the way who we are and the way we feel about ourselves, and give us deeper insight into the nature of the reality, so that we're no longer in the grip of the illusion of thinking it exists in the way that it appears. Is that kind of clear? Anyway, and did anybody have any other thoughts either about that or where we were since this morning? Hi, Amanda.
Hi. Good afternoon, everybody. Something I wanted to share that's helped me was, I know traditionally you look at the self first and try and identify the non-inherent assumption. But Venerable Chodron recommends that rather than go the traditional way, you actually start off with objects, because our eyes are looking at them all the time. And it's almost as if you can practice it all the time. So, for instance, a pen. is reliant on so many causes and conditions, the person who designed it, the factory that made it, the plastic, the products within it, the metal bits, and then the ink inside it. Now, the ink, all of it's impermanent, but when the ink runs out, we go, oh, God, it's run out. You know, it's like shock, because we assumed permanence somewhere. And we can do that with everything we look at, how colours are pigments and things we eat are reliant on people that grew them and who cooked them and et cetera. And she recommends that you take a flower and start taking it apart. So very much like you've just been saying, Roy, but you're doing it for yourself. You're taking the petals off one at a time and saying, well, is the essence of flower in that petal? Is it in this leaf? And you dissect the whole, you pull apart the whole flower looking for that essence that you think is the inherent flowerness of the flower. And then you find that you've taken the whole thing apart and nothing was to be found. There was no inherent existence in either the parts or the whole aspect of the flower. And yet, when we glance at a flower, we're not thinking automatically. It's not as it appears. This is a dependent arising. So it kind of, I felt very useful and continues to be useful to almost constantly apply that sort of thinking to everything around me. And then it became easier to do it to myself and to others that we're possibly attached to see, well, they are impermanent, they're not as permanent as I think they're going to be, they will actually die, and so will I. So I just thought I'd share that, just see if anyone else might think
great.
That could be.
Yeah, it's a great observation to share, because of course, although it's traditionally set up that you can start with either the self or objects in the world, and then the teachers, either, you know, live or in maybe the text you're reading, say, but I'm going to start with the self. Of course, it doesn't mean that it's mutually exclusive, or the one is necessarily better than the other, and we're all of slightly different disposition. So some of us might find it easier to start with ourselves, others might find it easier to start with objects, but whichever way we go, it's certainly not mutually exclusive. So, you know, I quite like, even if, you know, I'm sitting here following the way His Holiness is doing it, which is starting with the self. But of course, you'll notice I've been out and about to other objects, and we actually started with a talk that was saying you can pick any of your sensory experiences, but we chose vision and then went into colour. And then we went, you can go even further and say the colour isn't even in the pigment. So the colour isn't in the brain, it's not in the mind, and it's not actually, there's no colour actually existing in the pigment, yet we see and experience colour. So, and His Holiness himself, if you've got the copy of How to See Yourself as You Really Are, he does a really beautiful one in there with a flower that he's relating to, that the flowers were part of offerings being made. But he does exactly that one with the flower. He said if you really look at all the attributes of the flower, where is the inherent existence? Because it's not the same as the attributes, but it's not different from them. But it doesn't mean you don't have a flower or an experience of the colour or the beauty or the smell or whatever of the flower. So it's a really, really good way of looking at it, and not to feel, oh, if I'm just sort of coming at this from the point of view of the self, I'll abjure what's going outside. I mean, in the break, because a beautiful sunny morning sort of became dark and stormy with stormy showers, but still some bits of sun, and I was thinking, oh, it could be a day on which it's possible to see a rainbow. And a rainbow is a brilliant example, because nobody would deny that rainbows exist. But we can't go and get them, can we? we can't say, oh, we'll send a helicopter up there and get a chunk of rainbow and bring it out. It appears, everybody can see it, it's intersubjective. It's beautiful, it gives rise to, you know, emotions, aesthetic feelings, scientific inquiry, and so on and so forth. And it arises in dependence on really a gathering of circumstances that have to do with light brought together in the medium of air, water, sunlight, and so on and so forth. And we know from our early kind of high school or secondary school physics that what's happening is the sunlight is refracting at a certain angle and producing the rainbow. Well, does it exist? Well, of course it exists. It's not that it doesn't exist. But is there any inherent existence either to the rainbow or any of the causes and conditions that came together to create it? No. And I think that one's particularly good because for me, the sense of self is rather like that. It arises on different causes and conditions. You know, I feel this way or I think on this way because this feeling has arisen, because there's something I like or something I don't like or whatever it is. And then in various forms, it can be very, very strong or not very much. But when it's strong, although I feel this really, you know, if this isn't real, nothing's real. But in actual fact, any observation or checking over time will demonstrate to me that it's no more real than the rainbow. It's got no more inherent existence than that rainbow. Those feelings and that way of thinking, well, if this isn't certain, what is, could change in an hour. So I think it really is good to, whichever way you happen to be coming at it, even if you're making the decision or following somebody who's saying, yes, look at the self, to also keep looking around and saying, well, if this is, particularly, I think if you get that feeling, oh, I've kind of lost that kind of target idea of myself as inherently existing, well, apply the same logic to the bowl, to the light, to the computer or whatever else. And you can say, oh, well, is there any inherently existing anything? And that's exactly where the Buddha was going. That's exactly as Nagarjuna interpreted him and all of the masters in the lineage subsequently, as it were. So I think it's a really, really important one. But even if you're not looking at the analysis solely in terms of oneself, one can keep on looking around. And then I think we were talking this morning about there's a kind of a distortion, particularly when we talk about the five senses, not just in Buddhism, but in general, because the sense of sight is so dominant. You know, we talk about a perception. Most of us, as soon as we think about perception, we think of seeing something. But of course, hearing something is an audio perception. Smelling something is an olfactory perception, tasting something and so on, then tactile. But there's this visual dominance where you can turn that kind of imbalance or weakness into an advantage by saying, oh, what I can see at any time, is there anything I can see that's actually inherently existing just in the way that it appears? Or is it just an appearance arising and abiding for as long as those particular causes and conditions sort of persist or apply? And when they don't, it either starts to fail to function or fall apart or disappear. It's kind of like that. Yeah, it's an excellent observation, I think. Thank you for that one.
Can I just add one little tiny bit?
Sure.
Is the interesting thing about the emptiness of the pen, emptiness is permanent but not always eternal. So when the pen shatters, breaks, gone, so is emptiness. Emptiness abides, or not abides. Emptiness is a characteristic of the pen or of the glass for as long as the glass is around. As soon as this glass is broken and gone, emptiness also is no longer there with the glass.
Yeah, emptiness is itself empty, and it's always worth asking. When we say, because it's difficult translation terms, really, it would be better if we had other words in English and in other languages to do duty for shunyata, but we don't. So, and our emptiness is got far too many connotations of nothing. Nothing.
Probably the assumption of permanent inherent existence is probably.
Yeah, but it's more often the problem is people thinking, what's the difference between emptiness and nothing? So it's certainly true that to get a hold on it is to say of anything, what is it empty of? Well, it's empty of inherent existence. So if this is a bookmark. If this is empty of inherent existence, when this is gone, then so has its emptiness of any inherent existence. But if you were referring to imagine a universe in which there were no things, it would still be empty. It's not that emptiness disappears, it's the emptiness of the inherent existence of the object concerned that disappears on the dissolution of the object. Back again to the Buddha, who would say, these things only have one taste, like the taste of the sea, salt. Yeah. So it's almost, it's out of everything, out of emptiness that everything comes. You know, if your form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Emptiness is not other than form. Form is not other than emptiness. So that which we experience, the appearances, are displays of emptiness. Yeah. Any other? Tony.
Yes, hi. So I found a little bit, I struggled a little bit with the arguments in the book in step three. I found them a little bit contrived. I couldn't relate to some of those. One thing which occurred to me in the last few hours is just to think about one's own body. So I don't know if you know, but the current sort of estimates are that we roughly have about 30 trillion cells and about 30 trillion microorganisms. That's what makes up our body. So it is very obviously our body is close to our being, our sense of I, but what is it? You know, does it include all the microorganisms in your gut, which apparently influence your tastes and many, many things about you?
Yeah.
Are they independent beings? And, you know, all the hundreds of thousands of cells you lose every day, are they still part of you? Or, you know, I think that's quite a fascinating one to think about, where actually is the boundary? And what actually is this body? Even we can't even determine that with the sort of knowing what we do about science now.
It's a really, really good observation, and it's really important to go there too, because the reason that there are quite a range of arguments traditionally, you know, that are brought forward. I mean, some of them do make extraordinarily good and fundamental points. You'll probably note that in the step we were taking in sameness and difference, I didn't use all the ones that His Holiness made. I used the ones that I thought would be most useful, and also the ones that unsurprisingly resonated well with me. And that's one of the things you can do. You can take the view that sometimes, oh, this is a rather bewildering array of arguments. But you can say, well, which ones actually strike a chord? Which ones you think, yes, I kind of get that. Or I've got an interest in that perspective. Or I can see that and then pursue down that line. If it's something which to you feels rather contrived, or there's something there. It's like, for example, if you're there are arguments along this line, particularly with, I think there's one that we were looking at this morning that kind of touches on it, which is that, you know, if the I the reified eye and the mind and body were one and the same, then if the mind and body ceased to exist, it would cease to exist. Well, if you don't believe in reincarnation, then you say, well, of course it does. So that argument's not going to cut a lot of ice. It's working on the assumption that you're someone that's sort of signing up to the idea that consciousness is beginningless and endless, and that the death of any one particular body is not going to mean the termination of beginningless and endless consciousness. And I very often don't use that one because I may be talking to people that don't share or have that particular belief, or, you know, if they're really lucky, I mean, some people may have experience of past lives, or that maybe all sorts of reasons for their conviction. But if you don't have it, that argument in itself is not going to cut much ice. Well, so I think it's really good to connect with, I think one of the reasons that the arguments from interdependence is called the king of reasons is because it's one that almost anybody can get into, understand and agree, because it's just so clear, so obvious, whatever any pre-existing belief system or inclination is. But I think, exactly as you've done, to say, whoa, that one's a bit contrived, it doesn't really appeal to me, there's not a lot of profit in sitting there, you know, trying to push it. Far better to, particularly if you're going to use it as an iterative process, to dig deeper and deepen the analysis of something that you have got that kind of feeling for or resonance with or really makes sense to you. And then, whilst we know you can kind of understand the conceptual work that's being done with the logical argument, I think it's really good then to say, well, can I come up with my own? And then maybe it's not just turning on logical argument, but thinking in slightly different ways about our own experience and what we know about ourselves, exactly as you've done, by say, okay, come at it from a cellular point of view. You know, this heap of aggregates, form, feeling, perception, compositional factors, and consciousness. Well, you know, what are those five depend upon? And if we just go for form, you know, and not thinking in the Buddhist sense, the form also includes the way it appears and factors that we would include in perception. But if we reduce it for a moment, you know, a quick and easy job to say the material basis, and then say, well, how's that made up? We do the same, don't we? We can do exactly the same, even with skin. You know, there it is. It's always there. So I think, I'm covered in a layer of skin and I can read a bit of dermatology. And then I read a bit more dermatology and, all of a sudden, that white stuff that appears if I put black sheets on is coming off all the bloody time. That's why we have to hoover, and that's why we have to wash things, because it's not stable. It's kind of disintegrating and remaking moment by moment. And when it doesn't, I'm dead. But I would think, look at it. It's a nice sort of consistent, coherent, independently existing layer of skin. And then quite where does that, is it like, you know, can I just, yeah, you know, if a butcher gets in here, he can skin me, if you like, and there's a rough doing it, but you'll know if you've ever done anything like that yourself. Well, there's a kind of an arbitrary decision about where the dermis ends and the muscle begins. It's not a clear cut boundary any more than it's clear cut, speaking about it in a less gory way, about, well, okay, if this is my wrist, where does my arm end? Where does the wrist begin? And where does the hand go? And if I were to say, this is my wrist, then no, Roy, it's too high. But if I come down here, they say, that's better. Maybe. That's in the middle. Now you're getting a bit army, you know. Then you begin to realize that, again, it's just a conceptual designation, convenient, so that we can communicate and talk to one another. There's no inherently existing boundary between here and here, but by convention, by the use, common use of language, we've got a kind of an agreement about, no, Roy, you can't tell me your elbow is your wrist. But if you want to say, oh, my wrist here, you know, the kind of bottom end, you'd say, yeah, all right. And then to go into the cellular stuff as you did and start thinking about all the organisms, you immediately sparked off one that interested me, because, you know, for a long time it was thought that certain cells were only ever to be found in the brain. Now it appears that there are lots of them to be found in our gut too. Actually, you know, in the stomach needs them, but they play a part in our decision-making, behaviours, general experience of consciousness. So, oh, it's not just about all in the brain then, and so on. So I think these are fascinating ways of getting into nothing really having any inherent existence in this sense of being singular, permanent, partless, self-sufficient, not dependent on anything else, very tightly defined, totally concrete. It's a great way in. But yeah, as you go through the literature, you'll come across quite a lot of lines of argument. Well, I mean, in this, for what we're doing here, I'm just using two, and that's this fourfold method, which is largely resting on same and different and dependent arising. But there are many other ways in, many other ways of looking at it. And of course, in addition to the kind of conceptual or philosophical analysis, I'm also trying to say, well, also feel your way into it. You know, really see if you can experience how it is for you, looking at the rainbow, just looking at the flower. The other one is water, you know, looking at waters. Really, really amazing, because we saw there's a river over there. But when you look at it, even the water, you know, rushing and so on and so forth. I mean, Heraclitus style, you know, pre-Socratic philosopher, can you put your foot into the same river twice? No, because it's endlessly rushing. But when we see it, sometimes running over rocks, it appears to have a form. And almost solid, it's almost like you could, but of course you can't. And moment by moment, especially when it's playing fast, there's this illusion of a consistent, unchanging volume. Waves in the sea, I think, are another one like that. You know, we know what a wave is. We can identify and individuate waves. Artists can draw them. You know, we can think some are beautiful or whatever else, and they arise, kind of appear, and then crash back into what? And were they ever anything other than water? But does it mean waves don't exist? No. That their appearance kind of arose dependent on many different causes and conditions of how water in oceans behaves, as it were. So I think that's a great way in too.
Roy, I think Olga's got a question.
Ah, hello. Olga, thank you. Picking that one up, eh? Olga was just a little bit, got rid of something there. Now I can see. Oh, now you've come down here. It's better. Yeah.
Thanks. I lowered my hand. Thank you so much. Just on this moment where we're discussing an interesting analogy came to my mind is thinking of the conceptions that we as humanity create as something like a mosaic or pieces of mosaic that we cut depending on how we find is best to interact with each other, or like a pieces of stained glass. It's almost like, you know, if you have a wrist and that's one of the piece of the sort of a mosaic or a stained glass that we cut conceptually. And then we decided that the hand is the bigger piece, and we made all different cuts of pieces of mosaic, to actually form different parts of the hand, or, you know, to call it this way. It's almost like, we are creators of a conceptual mosaic or a conceptual stained glass picture that basically we actually are the ones who are doing this, as opposed to something out there being as it is. But actually, my question is more about, well, and excuse my ignorance, but it's how do emptiness and consciousness relate to each other?
That relationship is very similar, if not exactly the same, as the relation of emptiness to everything else. I mean, when you were just speaking, just, you know, if we just wind back a little bit, there's no doubt that we're making a contribution to our experience, i.e., it's not that we're passive recipients of something that's being generated outside us. Neither are we the sole creators of it. You know, we're both agents and spectators, if you like, in the drama of the universe. And it's the combination of us as conscious beings alive here and now in this world that give rise to the experience that we're having and everything that we see and can investigate, hear, smell, taste, touch, think about. So it's the whole of our experience is a dependent arising that has, if we're going to use that, just the problems of dualistic language, both internal and external causes and conditions, bearing in mind that there's no inherently existent internal or external, it's just a convenient, conventional way of looking at it. So the relationship between consciousness and emptiness is the one that says consciousness, there's no inherently existing consciousness. Consciousness is itself a dependent arising that's empty of any inherent existence. If the causes and conditions are right, then you have consciousness. And you also have it being what it is in the same way that everything else, it has causes and conditions that it shares with other things and dependencies that it may share with other things, but also causes and conditions that are kind of wholly its own. So if you look at it from the point of view of Buddhist philosophy, the present moment of consciousness, its most proximate, you know, its most immediate cause is the previous moment of consciousness and the moment of consciousness before that. But amongst the kind of conditions on which it depends, if somebody takes my brain away right now, then it's not going to be able to manifest or act as a support for consciousness in the way it is now. So it's the consciousness is dependent on this psychophysical organism in order to manifest in the way that it does. But looked at from the point of view of the stream of consciousness, the cause of the present moment of consciousness is the previous one, and the cause of the next one is the one being experienced now. And then in terms of that experience, there are things that come in virtue of the consciousness or come in virtue of this particular conglomeration of the five aggregates and five senses in a human body that, in that sense, I, as the mere I, bring to that experience. But there's also lots of other causes and conditions that impact on it too. Is that making sense?
I think so. So would it be correct to say that emptiness is a quality or certain characteristics of the consciousness?
In the sense that everything is empty of inherent existence. So all conditioned things, you get that if we go back to our daily prayers in the Foundation of All Good Qualities by Tsongkhapa, there's a quote from the Diamond Sutra, you know, like a bubble a flash of lightning. That's actually a verse from the Diamond Sutra, which is a slightly longer sutra in the Perfection of Wisdom literature than the Heart Sutra, the Heart Sutra being the shortest, as it were. But that phrase, that one there, is giving you an idea of what's going on. It's like that. Yeah, these things arise in dependence on causes and conditions and disappear when the causes and conditions are no longer there. So emptiness marks all conditioned phenomena. Anything that's produced in virtue of being produced, because it was caused and depends on conditions, can't have any inherent existence. What's inherent existence? Something that's singular, permanent, partless, wholly independent, not dependent on anything else, self-sufficient, existing from its own side. As soon as something's dependent on causes and conditions, can't be there. So empty of inherent existence. In that sense, yes, everything is marked by emptiness, and you can say emptiness is a kind of a characteristic or an attribute of all conditioned things. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, Judy.
Something that often sort of bends my mind or whatever is this whole concept of how our consciousness is conditioned by our past lives. If there's nothing that's carrying the imprints from those past lives, I sometimes always want to think that there's something that's carrying our past lives on our consciousness, but, you know, I know in theory there isn't, but I still kind of want there to be.
Ah, I think this may be, it's like, yeah, this may help in the sense that, you know, as we're speaking now, we're discussing or trying to understand that we don't have any inherent existence. Yeah, there's no inherently existing reified I. But we're still here, no? Mm-hmm. Talking over Zoom and so on and so forth. It's just that we don't exist in the way we appear. Well, similarly, if the mind stream or the consciousness is beginning and endless, yeah, then it doesn't have any inherent existence, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So what is it that goes on from one life to another in it, from a Buddhist perspective, from a point of view of Buddhist philosophy and the experience of its practitioners? It's the mind stream. There is a continuity of consciousness from life to life, because the previous moment of consciousness causes the next moment of consciousness, the next moment of consciousness causes the next moment of consciousness. There is a dependence for it to be the way we're experiencing it now on the body, the physical form and all the rest of it. But the kind of what's being posited here is when the body dies, there is still a stream of consciousness. It doesn't require inherent existence for that any more than you or I require inherent existence to be alive here and now. So it's not that there's nothing there. It's just that that mind stream, that consciousness, is not inherently existent. In the sense of, back to those words, you know, singular, permanent, partless, wholly independent, existing from its own side, totally self-sufficient. And indeed, if you look into the kind of accounts of karma and the bardo, you know, how consciousness continues moment to moment, let alone after what we would call physical death is conditioned by the previous experience of the consciousness. So going back into that kind of six realm theory, you know, of saying, well, the universe has six realms, as it were, and it's driven by greed, hatred, and ignorance, and this transmigration through those six realms. There's three upper and three lower. Well, sort of, and then you've got on the wheel of life those kind of, you know, there's a black half and a white half, and you've got some going down to lower realms, some going up to other realms, and this is indicating that the nature of the experience generates consequences which condition the future and the way that consciousness unfolds or experiences. So it's not that there's nothing there. What all that's being said is there's nothing inherently existent. Yeah, and maybe it's good also to think it's coming by looking a bit at the background of a particular line in non-Buddhist philosophies and religious beliefs of South Asia at the time, which could be a little bit paralleled by a Judeo-Christian Islamic view of this idea of an immortal soul that, you know, it is always there, no matter what, unchanging, blah, 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 blah. And then is, in their case, you know, judged by somebody else to be fit for this or fit for that and so on and so forth. From the Buddhist perspective, they were saying, no, nothing like this exists. There's no inherently existing thing there. There's a mind stream. There's consciousness, and moment by moment by moment by moment, it keeps generating. That's what being alive is all about. Yeah, kind of like that. But that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just doesn't inherently exist. Because it depends on all these other causes and conditions. It's a dependent arising. It's only our view of it as something completely separate that's being challenged. Is that helpful or not?
It is helpful, and I can understand it all in theory, but I still don't know how actions that I might have done many, many lifetimes ago can still be in my particular consciousness, but I think I'm still getting hung up about something inherent.
What I've always done for myself is to just understand how it is now.
Yeah.
So, it doesn't have to be dramatic. We don't have to get into the area of trauma if it's kind of a negative thing, or anything on the positive side, but just in some ways, there are this like it's like anything else too. It's like we're not odd in this way. Everything is the same. Some effects are very proximate to the cause.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some are more distant. Yeah, or some may intermittently fire. You know, it's the same with everything. I mean, sometimes you get fires caused by something that was done a few hours ago. But if you make fire a different way, it'll catch fire immediately. Yeah, so it's kind of like that. And I was thinking, I think it was on Sunday. I was reading something. And that something came to mind, reminded me of something. I thought, oh, that was a long time ago. And I thought back, I could remember exactly when it was. It was when I was 19. And I could remember where I was. And there was something about that that I thought, that's still in its own way vaguely conditioning the way I am. It's still having an effect. But there are some things that have been long gone. There are some things that have run their course, spent. There'll be other things in the middle. And then there's some, aren't there, that are, you know, it's kind of, I think we get it very well if we were trying to say, I don't want sugar in my tea. You know, after about 8 days, it's actually, once you go past the craving for sugar, say 8 to 10 days, then if somebody puts two sugars in your tea, it's like, oh, it's not quite good. And then you may go and you don't put sugar in your tea anymore, but you might see something, or the thought might come that might say, I really kind of fancy something sweet. It kind of comes back again. Other things don't. You know, some people can give up smoking by literally throwing whatever they've got in the packet into the bin and walk away from it and never smoke another cigarette. Other people try and try and try as best they can and can't give it up or have real difficulty giving it up. So these can all be very different, very individual. And all of those differences and all the sorts of things that are going on there are dependent on the particular causes and conditions of our own circumstances. No? Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah.
So if you can see, I always think if you can see that in this lifetime, even if you have no experience of a previous lifetime, you can say, but if it were the case, consciousness is continuous, I can see how the mechanism works.
Mm.
Yeah, I can see how the mechanism works. I mean, it's a hot area for debate, and there isn't any answer. But I mean, some people might say, well, how is it that if we try and take out the conditioning aspects, the educated aspects, why are some children extraordinarily precocious at music?
Mm.
It's like, why Mozart? Or anything else, you know, that's just an example.
Mm.
And you're thinking, well, is it possible that there was something there before that has a disposition that way, that had training, that had understanding? I mean, there is one that, I mean, you look at Plato. If you look at Plato, for example, he had a theory in respect of learning anything that actually we don't learn much, but we remember stuff. You know, and then there is a kind of a learning that goes on, but a lot of it is based on remembering prior experience, which he also thought was to do with metempsychosis, some kind of previous lives or experience. But I think the simple answer for this is saying, if you're looking for the mechanism, just look right here, right now. Don't even think about it in terms of past lives. Say, how is it that something that maybe happened when I was a child, or something that I learned to like or dislike a long time ago, or something that occurred to me, or a book that I read suddenly came back. You know what I mean? How does that work? And then the principle is exactly the same, however, over however long a time you want to think about it.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, it's 16:10. So let's go back to a little meditation. If you find a comfortable posture, bring the attention from wherever it is now. Bring it in a simple and uncontrived way to the gates of the senses, to what we can see, hear, smell, any residual tastes. The totality or the ocean of bodily sensations. Just Just rest there for a while. Check out what's going on in mental consciousness, like a sixth sense. Maybe just the metaphorical space of the mind, awareness itself. Maybe big background emotions, positive, negative, or neutral. Undercurrent thought, involuntary processing. Memories, images, whatever's there. Don't correct it, don't modify it, don't indulge it. If you're identified with it, just let go. Simplify, drop back down into the body. Not blocking anything else out, just choosing to place the single-pointed mindful attention on the felt somatic sensations of the body. Still in body, speech, and mind, with the senses vividly alive. Narrow the focus of the attention further to bring that bright, alert attention to the sensations of the breath in the body. Kind of tidal ebb and flow of sensations within the totality of the ocean of bodily sensations. Just rest there, present in those sensations, brightening them on the in-breath, if they're dull. Using the out-breath like a sigh, just letting go completely of anything we may be holding on to mentally, physically, or emotionally. On the out-breath, just relaxing more profoundly into the posture and the practice. And just simply resting there for a while. Allowing mind and body together to settle into the natural state. The attention becoming more stable and balanced as it keeps returning to the rhythm of the sensations of the breath in the body. And then just gently let go of these sensations of the breath in the body as an anchor for the attention. Leave everything else the same, just remain resting in. Single-pointed, undistracted, mindful attention. In completely open, choiceless awareness. Present to whatever experience arises, abides for a while, changes, transforms, or disappears back into the space of consciousness. Just reflect again, gently. If the I exists as we experience it, as it appears, kind of somehow, independent of mind and body, inherently existing from its own side, and we can approach it logically and think it's either one with mind and body. If something like this one actually exists, if we can come up with it, we can find it, then logically it's either one with the mind and body or entirely different from the mind and body. It's kind of either one way or the other, no three ways about it. Which is what the law of excluded middle is all about. So just recap on that, kind of reflect and analyze your experience right here, right now. Ask yourself whether the felt sense of I that appears to be inherently self-established in the context of our experience, however we feel it right here, right now. Rooted in our psychophysical organism, the experience of our mind and body, does it have a way of existing other than either being a part of or separate from our mind and body? If it's either not a part of or separate from mind and body, what other sort of existence could it have? Sort of either think or feel your own way into that. Make your own investigation. with or without words, and feel your way in, or your little of each, however you want. See within the boundaries of the presence. Single-pointed, mindful, non-distracted attention, completely open. You can begin to think without disturbing that too much, or begin to feel without disturbing that too much. Into this question about whether there is any third possibility. If you kind of come to a conclusion that, yeah, no, it's kind of clear, I understand that in this case it has to be either one way or the other. When you've done enough thinking or feeling, then just let go. Rest without pursuing it anymore in alert, relaxed, completely open, choiceless awareness, present to whatever is in your experience at the moment, and just rest there with nothing more to do. When you hear the strike of the gong, just let go completely, neither meditate nor not meditate, but just be present with whatever experience you have. Okay. Faye, I've just done what I'd normally do to save the chat box, and I think I've done that. But could you save yours so that if I find that it's disappeared, you can send it to me, yeah?
Yeah, no problem.
That would be great. If you act as a backup, if you don't hear anything from me, you know I've found it, or that it's successfully downloaded into my file. But there was just something there. I thought, oh, it's not quite as it was. But I'll say both the Zoom and the software here have recently been updated. So it might just be me not as used to it as I am normally. Okay. So we'll finish with the dedication prayers. Between now and tomorrow morning, alternate with some sessions of just straight shamatha, where you're doing no analysis at all, but see if you can get a couple of short sessions in where you do a little analysis as far as we've done, and see if you can also bring some of your own intuition, experience, arguments, or ways of feeling into it. You know, you've got, seems to me, a very good grasp of the basic principles, kind of a good understanding of what this rather strange thing is that we assume most of the time in terms of an inherently existing rarefied I. And a good grip of the kind of clear, simple sense of the logic that says, okay, if we think that such a thing does exist, then how does it exist? Can we kind of find one? Can we come up with it? And to kind of pursue that on the grounds, well, either it must be the same as mind and body or different from it, but feel free to find your own ways into that. And supplement it with your own observations. You know, as Amanda was saying, as we're going about our business, we can focus on other things and also other senses and see if we can get a feel for the way our experience of them and indeed the way they kind of depend continually on other causes and conditions for their apparent existence. And how, if they change, then the appearance changes. And if the causes and conditions that support them are no longer there anymore, they break down, they dissolve, they disappear. So have a look at that, because there's an illusion-like quality to our experience that we often miss or are not present to if we're constantly reifying ourselves and everything else, deceived by thinking, oh, they exist in the way they appear when they don't. Jang chub sem cho rin po shi ma kir pa nam kir gu jing kir wa nyam pa me pa yang gong le gong lu Elwaju Tony Tawa Rinpoche Makir Panam Kyaguzing Kyapa Nyampa Mepayam Gongne Gongdu Pelwaju. May the precious supreme bodhicitta not yet born arise. May that arisen not decline but increase more and more. May the precious few of emptiness not yet born arise, and may that arisen not decline, but increase more and more. Thank you very much. Much look forward to seeing you all tomorrow. In the meantime, stay well. Go safe.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, everyone.
Enjoy your sessions.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.